Hi, everyone, and welcome to Game of Thrones and Medievalism, a podcast created for a fourth-year history course at the University of Northern British Columbia. In this podcast, our goal is to chat with experts about, you guessed it, Game of Thrones and medievalism. But what exactly does medievalism mean, and how do we use it to study Game of Thrones? My guest today, Dr. Alicia McKenzie, is going to explore those questions and help us unpack exactly what this term medievalism means and how we can think about it as a framework for examining Game of Thrones.
Alicia is an instructor at Wilfrid Laurier University. She is a historian and a medievalismist, and her forthcoming book, Recreating Worlds, Representations of Pre-Modern History in Video Games, highlights these two fields. So Alicia, first of all, I want to thank you so much for participating in this podcast. I really appreciate your willingness to share your expertise on the topic of medievalism.
I'm really glad to be here.
We had discussed before, the first time I taught this course, I really didn't have an understanding of what medievalism meant. And I think because of that, it really impacted my students' ability to understand this term and why it's really important, but also why we need to think about what it means in order to really understand things like Game of Thrones. So let me start with a question. What exactly is medievalism? How would you define it?
Well, it's funny that we start with that, because if there's one thing that medievalismists have argued about for as long as there have been medievalism studies, it's how you define medievalism. I mean, I have a preferred definition. It's not the only definition, but to me, it's the one that's both broad enough to be useful and provide a sort of starting point for students and still conveys some of the complexities of the concept. So I'm just going to read it here.
Yeah, perfect.
Medievalism is the art, literature, scholarship, avocational pastimes, and sundry forms of entertainment and culture that turned to the Middle Ages for their subject matter or inspiration, and in doing so, explicitly or implicitly, by comparison or contrast, comment on the artist's contemporary sociocultural status. So that's from Tyson Pugh and Angela Jane Wiesel, Medievalism Making the Past and the Present. So to me, that definition is important because it has layers. So it's not just that there are activities or creative forms that use the medieval for inspiration. It's also that they use the medieval to comment on the modern. So they are creating meaning for a modern audience from the medieval or their concepts of the medieval.
Yeah, that's actually the explanation and the quotation that I use in my course syllabus for Game of Thrones, because I agree, I really like the fact that it brings in not only the fact that medievalism focuses on this representation of the Middle Ages and this creation of it, but also that it reflects on our contemporary world, right? And that there's those kind of two components to that definition that we need to think about, not only the historical component, but also the contemporary component as well. And I know you teach a first year course on medievalism. How do you find your students being able to kind of tackle this complexity?
They actually do very well with it, I would say. They come into these courses in the first year expecting a fun course, you know, something on Game of Thrones or Harry Potter or Skyrim. That's what draws them to it. But what amazes me is how willing they are to delve a little bit deeper, to look at how these creative examples that they've lived with and loved for so long actually have this fascinating relationship with real history and real culture from the past, and why we have that relationship still in the present. I always tell them that that's the big question. Why do we care about the medieval? Why do we still care? Why does it still come back again and again and again? And they love talking about that. And it's a genuine thrill to hear them discussing it in tutorials and during lectures. So,
yeah, I found my students too. It took us a while to kind of get to that unpacking all those different aspects of that definition. But once we got there, they thought it was really fascinating to think about that relationship. And as a history professor, that's one of the things that's really important to me to talk to my students about, is what is the relationship between the past and the present, right? And how we understand that relationship in all these different ways. So one of the things that I like about that definition is this emphasis on explicit and implicit. So I wonder if you could kind of tease that out a little bit and explore it in a bit more detail for me.
Okay, well, I'll give you two examples specifically from two of the courses I teach. So I teach a Game of Thrones course at the first year level and a Harry Potter course. So Game of Thrones, the medievalism is right there in your face.
Yeah.
There's so much medievalism. You don't have to look very far to find the medieval in Game of Thrones. But I bet if you walked up to somebody on the street and said, Harry Potter is a profoundly medievalist text, they would look at you and say, what are you talking about? But when you start to dig in Harry Potter, beneath the surface, there is so much medievalism. There is medievalism that you don't necessarily see. So why, for example, does Hogwarts look in different parts of Hogwarts, like a Gothic cathedral or a castle? What is the meaning that's conveyed by this weird hybrid magical castle and all of its ties to the Middle Ages and actual architectural forms? What is that trying to say to the audience?
That's a really good point. I teach about Harry Potter in the context of my witches course, of course. But I hadn't really ever thought about the connection between Harry Potter and medievalism before. So that's given me some food for thought to think about where I can see those aspects of it. So why do you think people are so fascinated by the Middle Ages? What do you think is this? Because one of the things I discovered in the context of my own foray into medievalism is that the Middle Ages is the time period that's most represented in our contemporary culture in terms of film and television shows and novels and other types of creative enterprises. So what is it about the Middle Ages that is so fascinating for people?
Well, it's that the Middle Ages are two things. The Middle Ages are both a golden age and a dark age. The Middle Ages are the age of knights in shining armor, beautiful damsels, great quests, beautiful artwork, sort of more of a connection with the natural world on what you yourself as a hero can create for your life. But it's also a time of plague and war and people behaving horribly. You know, it's a time that you can look back on and say, well, I'm glad we're no longer medieval. Let's not be medieval. So because it can serve both of those purposes, it satisfies two completely different sets of needs. So if you want to read something that makes you, if you're yearning for a simpler time, a more honorable time, if you love the concept of chivalry, for instance, you can find that in the Middle Ages. But if you also want to be really relieved that you live in the 21st century, that you're, you know, maybe you're female and you like having, you know, loads of legal rights and so forth, you can read the Middle Ages and sort of get a bit of a vicarious thrill about the progress that you see or supposedly see our society has actually gone through. I don't necessarily agree with anything I just said, by the way. I mean, it's their perceptions of the Middle Ages, right? I mean, I would bite a student's head off if they called it the Dark Ages in a serious way, but it's the image of the Middle Ages as a Dark Age that can draw people in. Matthews calls it Gothic medievalism or grotesque medievalism, and talks about how, you know, if there's violence, if something sexual in an unpleasant way is going on, then that's Gothic medievalism versus romantic medievalism.
So, yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the things that we're going to cover in an upcoming podcast is actually the representation of this kind of sexual violence in Game of Thrones and why they felt the need to include that. And my colleague Sarah McDougall is going to talk to us about that. And I think it's a really interesting, I like how you've divided this into the idea of a golden age and a dark age, because I find that's how my students, when they first come to medieval history, that's what they come, how they get there, right? Is they think about medieval history as either the story of all these knights and ladies and who lived in these castles and had this, often they associate it with this kind of wonderful life, or they were peasants who like faced imminent death all the time and were kind of hoveling, you know, struggling around in the mud, kind of Monty Python-esque in some ways. And then to them, there's nothing in between. And so it's interesting that makes sense, right? That if this is how the Middle Ages is being represented, that this is what they're coming to history courses with.
Yeah.
And then they discover it's much more interesting than that. So that actually kind of leads into my discussion of Game of Thrones, because I think Game of Thrones is really good at representing that like golden age and that dark age together. So if we're going to use medievalism as a framework to think about something like Game of Thrones or Harry Potter or another topic like that, how do we do that? Like, what are the things that we should be looking for when we watch an episode of Game of Thrones if we want to analyze it through the lens of medievalism? What are some of the kind of components that we need to be thinking about?
Well, I think probably the first thing that we should always keep in mind when looking at Game of Thrones is that it is medievalist, but it is also neo-medievalist. And I don't know if that's a topic that you were going to cover or not in your course.
I think I'd like to talk about it. And can you explain a little bit the difference between medievalist and neo-medievalist and how that fits into medievalism?
Okay, so medievalism is sort of the umbrella term that covers all representations of the medieval. Neo-medievalism is a term that it's actually somewhat, it's a bit of a debate lately as to whether or not we should still be using it because it's a bit vague. It came from Umberto Eco's original list of the 10 little middle ages. I'm going to give you another short quote. This one's from an article by Amy Kaufman, Medieval Unmoored. She said, "Neo-medievalism is thus not a dream of the middle ages, but a dream of someone else's medievalism. It is medievalism doubled upon itself." So it is a medievalist depiction or interpretation that is sort of mediated through other medievalisms.
Okay, that's interesting. Can you go into that a bit more and explain what she means by that?
Okay, so think of Game of Thrones. And if you read interviews with Martin, especially some of the earlier ones, mm-hmm. when Game of Thrones, as the show started taking off, he spent a lot of time talking about Tolkien. And
yes.
Talking about how what he was doing was different than Tolkien or a reaction to Tolkien. And so, you know, he is taking... You know, he's looking at Tolkien's medievalism and creating his medievalism in reaction to Tolkien. And Tolkien, of course, that was a medievalist depiction in and of itself, where he was looking at actual medieval history and culture and creating new languages and borrowing from the actual Middle Ages to create Middle Earth. So neo-medievalism is, you know, taking it a bit further. Now, oftentimes we use a much simpler definition of neo-medievalism, and we simply say that it is, you know, medieval themed fantasy, or it is where we see medieval elements or tropes that are removed from a medieval setting but are still recognizable as medieval. So for instance, Star Wars.
Okay.
You know, Star Wars is chock full of medievalism, even though it's science fiction.
Well, yeah, it's interesting. One of my former students did a really great discussion of the ideas of magic in Star Wars and kind of connected it to medievalism a few years ago in a course. And it was really fascinating for me to see. So it's interesting that you bring up Tolkien, because one of the things that I read about when I was preparing the first time I taught this course was all fantasy set in the Middle Ages is just responding to Tolkien. And that's it. So Martin is, among many others, a response to Tolkien as well, which I've read Tolkien and I've read Martin. I've read the books by Martin as well as having watched the series. I'm not an expert in medieval fantasy though. So, but I thought it was an interesting comment that Tolkien has had this such an impact that now we're seeing it in this way, right? That there's this neo-medievalism that is this response to him.
I mean, it's changed in the last little while. There are more distinct forms of neo-medievalism that don't perhaps have quite the same relationship to Tolkien, but he casts a very long shadow.
Yes, yeah.
Very long shadow.
I think that's why there's still so many sessions about his work in medievalism conferences, but also medieval studies conferences too. Okay, so when we start looking at Game of Thrones and we think about it in the context of medievalism, and the first thing we need to think about is neo-medievalism. So what do we do there? What should we be looking for in that context?
Well, I remember when I taught my first Game of Thrones course back in 2015, I told my students that when Martin created A Song of Ice and Fire, he basically stuffed the Middle Ages in a blender and hit frappe.
That's a great definition, actually.
Yeah, and actually, over the years, I've stuck with that because really, if you look at what he's doing, he is taking elements of medieval history and culture, he is removing them from their original context, altering them, and then recombining them into an entirely new form. So it's really interesting because he's breaking the connections to the context that they had. And yet, they're still there. Like, if you know about the Wars of the Roses, you can look and see parallels between some of the characters. Now, where those characters end up is completely different in a lot of cases from where the historical figures ended up. So it's more inspiration or evocation rather than a direct reflection. So, you know, you need to have a certain level of historical knowledge to see these parallels in the first place. And what's really interesting is to ask yourself, when you establish that knowledge, you know, why did he pick what he picked? You know, why did he use what he used? There's an article I read once. I cannot remember the author. It was just a little short blog online. She was a historian, and she said that medieval historians should stop talking about Game of Thrones.
Interesting.
Yes. And her argument was that because it wasn't historical fiction, that you could only talk about influence and inspiration, and it was too vague, that it could mean anything. And my problem with that argument is that, yeah, it could mean anything, but to Martin, it meant something.
Yes.
What did it mean? And what did he think it would mean to his audience? Just because the meaning, the relationship is a bit tortuous, or, you know, you're not able to point from point A to point B. And he himself said that. He said there are no one-to-one correspondences, that was his exact words, between historical figures or historical events and characters or events in his books. But it doesn't mean those relationships aren't there. It just means that you're looking at them through kind of a broken window, I suppose, and you have to focus a little harder and, you know, maybe be a little bit more creative and flexible to figure out what relationship does this have to the history. And of course, it also brings up questions of how he's, I don't want to say warped, but distorted certain aspects of history in order to fit. And probably the best example of that, if you look at his depiction of the Dothraki, who are very stereotypically dark-skinned Eastern horde. And then you compare them to the historical Mongols, who were from the East and who looked different than Europeans, yes, but who were fascinatingly complex in so many ways. And knowing that, knowing how he perpetuates popular stereotypes about the Middle Ages is critically important, because again, people are going to read Game of Thrones and they're going to see it as medieval. And these are the ideas that they're going to carry forward with them about what it is, what it was to be medieval, what the Middle Ages look like. And that you need to be aware of.
Yes. Yeah. And that's one of the things that is kind of at the core of our course. And part of the reason why our main textbook is Amy Kaufman and Paul Sturdivant's The Devil's Historians, is because I think one of the biggest issues that I have as someone interested in medievalism, but also as a medieval historian about Game of Thrones, is that it perpetuates these negative stereotypes about all kinds of people that lived in the medieval period, but that's what people then believe is what the Middle Ages was like. And I think, you know, part of our role as scholars is to talk to people and say, you know, no, that's not, it's not actually the Middle Ages, right? Like, it's representing this idea. But that's also a thing I found really fun, fascinating, is that people want to accept those stereotypes as true. Yeah. And that to me is a fascinating question. Like, what is it about? And I think maybe that gets us back to your point earlier about the Golden Age and the Dark Age, right? That to them, this is a simpler time where you could put people into these boxes and they stayed there in comparison to our own time period. But to me, that's even more troubling. So yeah, I think the importance of thinking about this idea of stereotyping, I think, is really crucial. And again, that's why I wanted to use The Devil's Historians, because I think it does such a great job of highlighting all these really problematic stereotypes that are embedded in our modern popular culture.
Every student of the Middle Ages needs to read that book.
I agree. It's just so accessible and such a well-written book too. I'm really excited to digging into it. So if we need to think about this idea of neo-medievalism and sort of why he picked the particular things that he did, and we also need to think about the fact that he's distorting these different aspects of history, are there any other questions that people should be thinking about when they approach this series?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, you need to look at the history and how he uses it, but you should also look at what kind of commentary he is trying to make about the modern day and why he needed a medieval setting to do it. because Game of Thrones talks about power, it talks about religion, it talks about violence, it talks about gender relations, and it does so in a deeply pessimistic way.
Yeah, I guess that says a lot about his time period, but also the time period of the show too, right? That because there are changes that the producers made from the books to the TV series that I think are representative of concerns within our contemporary culture, right? That they expected that modern popular audiences wanted to see.
Oh, yeah. I think that's something else that should be kept in mind, is that it's not just Martin whose take on this is important. It's also Benioff and Weiss. Yes. You know, there are actually three people in on this, because of course the series approaches certain things very differently than the book series did.
Yes. Yeah. That's one of the things we're going to talk about, is why they included, for example, the rape scene with Sansa. Like, why was that necessary? Right. I had a really long discussion on Twitter with various people about the last three episodes of the final season.
Don't get me started.
Yeah, I know. Okay, let's not go down that.
If that series had ended at Winterfell after the Battle of Winterfell, I would have been so much happier.
Yes, I think that to me too. Yeah, that's actually my favorite episode of the whole series, is that the Battle of Winterfell. I just think they did such amazing things with it.
I actually like the one right before it, the Night of the Seven Kingdoms.
That's what, yeah.
That was kind of Game of Thrones at its best to me, yes. The relationships between characters.
So how is sort of studying medievalism then, and I think we've already kind of got answered this question a little bit, different from studying medieval history? I'll preface this by saying the first time I taught this class, my students expected that we were going to talk about whether or not Game of Thrones is an authentic representation of the medieval period. And I said to them on the first day, so if that is what you think it's going to be about, the answer to that question, it is not. And the course is done. but I do think there's, and you've kind of highlighted that important relationship, right? So how are these connected together, and how are they different from one another?
So studying medievalism versus
medieval history, yeah.
Well, you know, the more I study medievalism, the more I'm starting to believe that the line is a bit blurrier than we like to admit. I mean, when you think about learning medieval history, especially your first few times learning medieval history, what sticks in your head the most, right? The narrative moments, yeah. The great stories. Now, as historians, we recognize that these narratives don't necessarily reflect objective reality. Like, the Pope did not sneak up behind Charlemagne at Christmas Mass and drop the crown on his head and say, "You're the emperor now." That's a narrative that was crafted to portray Charlemagne as someone who was worthy of power because he wasn't hungry for it. Now, when you look at medievalist texts, whether it's a book or a film or a TV series, their narratives crafted to portray a certain view of the past of historical figures, or just our idea of what's medieval. Now, obviously, a medievalist novel or a medievalist TV series is going to have a different relationship with history. It's created for different purposes than, say, a medieval chronicle. But I think there's more commonality there than people would like to admit. I mean, the average person likes to believe that history is fixed, that history is what happened in the past. It's a sequence of events. And as historians, we know that many of the primary sources we rely on are created to portray a particular view of events. And sometimes they don't portray things. There are silences. There are things that are lost between the lines. And I think knowing that and comparing that to how we look at medievalism is just really interesting. There was actually a Twitter conversation a few days back. Kathleen Kennedy, who's a very well-known medievalismist, just won a huge grant to work in the UK for like the next 5 years.
Oh, wow.
She was talking about, you know, when are we just going to give it up and admit that it's all medievalism?
Well, and I've talked to medieval historians, both who are skeptical of medievalism, and then medieval historians like me who are like, well, yeah, but everything that we write as historians is kind of medievalismist in a way, because we live in a contemporary society and we write about the past, right? So we're obviously influenced by our own contemporary society in the way that we interpret the past. Mm-hmm. So I'm a feminist historian. I write about gender history. The way I approach gender history is from a feminist perspective. So therefore, that's kind of medievalismist in a way. I mean, in how I think about it.
The other thing to think about is that, you know, people have been reinventing the Middle Ages since they ended.
Yes.
You know, they have been writing about them. They have been using them for various things. Like, look at the Tudors and their use of even medieval jousting is like a sort of a social and ceremonial thing. I think about Arthurian propaganda through the years. You know, it's we have this intrinsically creative relationship with the Middle Ages. We use them to do things with, and that's been going on since the end of the Middle Ages. So I think that needs to be recognized as a legitimate and important part of our relationship with that part of our history.
So. Yeah, and I think, I mean, in some ways, I think medievalism is a way for us to really talk about that tension that is often ignored when we think about history between how history is constructed in the present and then the things that happened in the past, right? And that tension is really important to think about broadly, regardless of the time period that you're exploring. But medievalism is a particular field that does that, right? In ways that don't necessarily happen in other people that study other time periods. So maybe some ways medievalismists are ahead of other historians, and at least recognizing, right, that like that's a thing that we need to think about.
Well, you know what's interesting is that a lot of what medievalismists do, classical reception scholars also do. I did some guest videos for a colleague at Laurier who does a course on the ancient world and contemporary culture. And I talked about the previous two Assassin's Creed games, the ones that were set in Ptolemaic Egypt and the Peloponnesian War. And it turned out when she watched these that the theoretical approaches that I took to talking about them were very much in tune with what classical reception scholars do. So I'm beginning to think that medievalismists need to talk more to classical reception scholars. Like, they have a very different relation. We have a very different relationship with the ancient world than we do with the medieval world. We look back to it for different reasons. But if we could have like a shared set of tools and start talking about, you know, why is it that as modern people we are drawn to the pre-modern so much, you know, that those are valid big questions, but valid questions.
Yeah, I think they're really important questions that we as historians need to grapple with, right? And need to recognize that they are really important questions for our students to think about too, right? That history is about thinking about our relationship with the past, because that's the reason why we get interested in it. Right? There's a reason why it interests us. So we need to think about that too as a source of academic study. So you just brought up video games. So can you tell me a little bit about your own research projects and what you're working on now, and in particular, the book that you're working on pre-modern history and video games?
Oh yeah, my poor book. It's written. I needed to make some revisions to it because it's meant to be like almost like a textbook for a pre-modern history and video games book, and it needed to be pitched a bit differently. But of course, my editor and I were just discussing this at the beginning of last March, and then the world blew up. So you know, no. I've been struggling to catch up and get the edits done ever since. But basically, what I look at is primarily open world RPGs. There are a couple of exceptions where I've got a couple of action adventure games and so forth in there as well, but how they make use of both the ancient world and the medieval world, how they represent it. And also, like, a lot of them are neo-medieval, because what's really interesting, if you look at video games, is that there are very few RPGs set in the ancient world. And the ones that are now, like the really big ones, tend to be very historically oriented. Mm-hmm. But there are a lot of RPGs set in the medieval world, and yet a lot of them are neo-medieval. And yet they have fleshed out worlds, like, remarkably detailed and complex worlds that you can point out parallel after parallel after parallel to the actual Middle Ages. And the reason that I wrote the book to start with is that I really started to realize that the depth of the world building in these games within the last 5-6 years especially allows for just incredibly detailed medievalism. And if you are trying to build a world that the player is going to inhabit for perhaps like 150 hours, that's going to feel real to them. You can't just base it on medieval literature. You have to base it on a world. You have to draw on social structure, on physical structures, on social relations. Otherwise, it's an empty world, right? So there's just so much to talk about with these games. And I'm now wishing I'd like waited a year to write it, because I'm now playing Assassin's Creed Valhalla, which really ought to be a chapter in the book, because it is just the way it engages with Scandinavian medieval history is unreal. So that's the book. And it's a chapter by chapter survey of some of the key games. Like I look at Assassin's Creed, I look at Skyrim, Dragon Age, Witcher. I digress a little bit into Dungeons and Dragons, because that is a huge influence on the shape of medievalist computer games.
Yeah.
But I also look at things like the Witcher 3 Wild Hunt, which is probably the high watermark so far for medievalist world building. It's enjoyable. I wish I could get the edits done and get it back to the publisher, but that'll happen. I just need to keep plugging at it.
Well, it sounds like a really valuable book too, for those of us that are interested in thinking about medievalism in different contexts.
Well, I hope so. That's the goal. I mean, the thing is, not everybody's going to have played all of these games. So trying to balance between giving as much information as I can about each example versus actually analyzing it, it is tricky to keep it to a nice, respectable length. But
yeah.
I also have a chapter coming out in a book on Skyrim this spring. It's a book that celebrates the 10th anniversary of the release of the game. I think mine is maybe the only one. No, I think I've got at least one or two on medievalism in it. But I look at how it draws on late antique history, rather than Viking history, as it appears to draw on. It's kind of, I don't want to say residual medievalism, because it's actually very overt if you know what you're looking for. But it's like you got the Viking veneer in Skyrim, and then underneath it's all late Roman.
Yeah.
It really is.
So this is something I think you see often in medievalism, right? The kind of blending of these different time periods.
Yeah, I called it in an article I published last year, a patchwork world, where you take pieces of the Middle Ages from different times and different places and you reassemble them in a way that maybe appears to make no logical sense if you're thinking about reflecting actual history, but which, when you have this patchwork world, what it means is that your player, wherever they are in the game, they're seeing something that seems like it's medieval to them.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think you see that too in shows like Game of Thrones, right? One of the things I've read a lot about is how Game of Thrones is sort of this, I guess, neo-medieval representation, but that a lot of the discussion around politics in particular is much more early modern, right? And much more drawing on people like Machiavelli that are not really reflective of how those ideas were discussed in the supposed medieval period, right?
Yeah, there was a famous blog entry called Game of Thrones Isn't Medieval and This Is Why that came out early in the show's run. And I used it for a number of years in my Game of Thrones course. I would give it to the students and say, why is this full of nonsense? Yeah. Because he started by claiming that all of these things in Game of Thrones never existed in the Middle Ages, like banks and navies and that sort of thing.
Yeah, no bank. Well, there's no money in the Middle Ages.
This is the problem with internet publishing. Stuff like that lives forever in infamy, right?
Yes, but yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think I've actually read that article, and I think I also assigned it the first time I taught this course, and then was like, this is kind of ridiculous. And I think one of the things that you're highlighting is these are arbitrary decisions that we make about when one period begins and another period ends, right? And that there's a lot of continuity across time periods that is maybe picked up in many of these representations of the Middle Ages, right? That unknowingly, maybe. So I think that that's a really interesting point. Well, I would just want to thank you so much for first taking the time to talk to me today about this. And I think I hope I have a better understanding of how we think about medievalism and the way that we can apply it to things like Game of Thrones. And I hope that my students will as well. And I really look forward to your book coming out. Do you have a publisher?
Yes, it's under contract with U of T Press.
So. Oh, excellent. That's great. Yeah. Their books are often also very affordable. So thank you so much. And I really appreciate you taking the time to do this today.
Well, it was great to chat to you about this. I love talking about medievalism. It's my favorite thing to do.
Alicia McKenzie is an instructor in the departments of History and Medieval Studies at Wilfrid Laurier University in Ontario. I will post references to the authors she mentioned in the podcast notes on our course website, including Alicia's own publications. Thanks for listening and have a great day.